Thanks a lot, Pedro. It's certainly a great privilege and pleasure to be speaking here today. So I think it's a great segue from the very end of what Tony was talking about. So this talk will involve quantum measurement, which is one of those things in quantum mechanics which you either simply accept or you think at very great lengths about. So for example, we might first learn about wave function collapse, this idea that a superposition under observation may collapse into one of its components. But then later, we might have a more sophisticated point of view. We might be told that we actually don't need to think about a separate collapse operation. Instead, we should think about the observer and the observed system evolving unitarily as part of a big wave function, and that the outcomes we perceive in an experiment are just part of one trajectory, one branch in this big superposition. But this is still somewhat unsatisfying because it's not clear when exactly new branches are created. Is this even a sharply defined process? Right. So later, maybe in grad school, we might be preoccupied with our career trajectory, let alone measurement trajectories, and you might pause thinking about these deep questions briefly. But as Tony pointed out, it's easy to be seduced by the foundations of quantum mechanics, and so at some point or another, we return to this measurement problem. And indeed, Tony has thought very deeply about this subject, and I encourage you to check out this very nice article. So unfortunately, I don't have much to say about this very deep measurement problem. And instead, this talk is about how to use measurement as a solution to unitary problems or unitary challenges. What exactly do I mean by that? So let's take it for granted that we have this operation measurement. It's a non-unitary operation. It's available in the lab. What can we do with it? What can we do with it that we cannot do with pure unitary time evolution by itself? Or things that are hard to do with unitary time evolution, how can measurement facilitate these things? So usually we think of measurement as something that we relegate to the very end of an experiment. We read out some observable at the end. But there's been a lot of interest in the quantum matter community in thinking about measurement as an intermediate operation, one that's on the same footing as unitary time evolution. So with both unitary and this non-unitary operation of measurement, what new physics can we achieve? What new protocols can we get? So in quantum information, this has already been a very fascinating and non-trivial example where measurements play an essential role, and that is quantum teleportation. So I think many of you already know this, let me just briefly remind you of the basics. So say you have two parties, Alice and Bob, which are very far separated. And say Alice has two qubits, Bob has one qubit, and one of Alice's qubits is entangled with Bob's qubit in this Bell pair, the superposition of 0, 0, and 1, 1. And now let's say Alice wants to send the state of her qubit, this red qubit, over to Bob without physically moving this red qubit over a very long distance. Then it turns out that all Alice needs to do is perform a Bell pair measurement on her two qubits. So all she needs to do is measure ZZ and measure XX on the two qubits she has. And after that measurement, her two qubits will now collapse into a Bell pair. And if it's the same Bell pair as the one that was originally shared between 2 and 3, if she got the outcome 0, 0 plus 1, 1, then it's pretty easy to check that Bob will have successfully recovered the state of Alice's qubit. And even if Alice gets a different Bell pair, a different measurement outcome than the one I just said, then she can simply communicate that outcome, which is simply some classical information, over to Bob. And based on that outcome, Bob can apply some corrective Pauli operator to recover Alice's red qubit. OK, so quantum teleportation is a fascinating example where with measurements and feedback based on that measurement outcome, you could do something very non-trivial. In this case, you can send quantum information a very long distance. Okay, but this example only involves 3 qubits. What about many-body systems? can we use measurements to really get new physics or protocols there? And this is not simply an academic question. So as you all know, there's been a lot of progress in developing quantum hardware with all sorts of approaches. And many of these approaches already have on the order of 50 to 60 qubits available. And many of them already have or are developing the capability to do this mid-circuit or intermediate measurements. So to actually carry out teleportation-like procedures in a many-body setting. So this really begs the question, how can we use measurement to do new things in a many-body setting? OK, so as a quantum matter theorist, one of the most interesting things in our field are long-range entangled matter. Okay. And so it was a natural objective to see how we can use measurement to facilitate the preparation of long-range entangled matter. So this is the work I decided to talk about today. And this is work done with Peter and Leo, who are here at Perimeter, and Isaac from UC Davis. So let me first remind you, what is long-range entangled matter? So long-range entangled quantum matter is very far from classical product-like states. Okay. So a key example of this long-range entangled matter is called topological order. So unlike conventional order, like this ferromagnet here, topological order is not characterized by any local order parameter. By looking at a local patch of the system, you cannot tell whether it's topological order or just some trivial order. And so instead, to characterize topological order, you need to look at more subtle and fascinating properties. So for example, topological order has quasi-particle excitations called anions, which have statistics that are neither bosonic nor fermionic. And this is just one of many interesting features of topological order. And so all this interesting physics has simulated many experimental groups that try to achieve a topological order in their labs. For example, using either arrays of Rydberg atoms, shown on the left, or superconducting qubits on the right. However, what makes long-range entangled quantum matter very interesting also makes it hard to realize in the lab. So almost by definition, long-range entangled quantum matter is far from classical product-like states. That's what I said. And more specifically, it cannot be prepared from trivial product states using any local unitary circuit of constant depth or time. Okay, so why is this? This is basically because of locality and causality. So any local unitary circuit has an emergent light cone which bounds the rate at which correlations can be created for points that are very far apart. Okay. There's a speed limit, right? And so since these long-range entangled quantum matter have long-range correlation, then to prepare these states, starting out with trivial product states with zero correlation, you need a unitary circuit with depth or time that scales linearly with the size of the system. And this can be very large. Right? So using local unitaries alone, there's no way to prepare these states in constant time independent of system size. So this is where measurements can really help out a lot. So in particular, we want to consider extended setup where we not only have local unitaries available, but also local measurements available. And furthermore, motivated by the teleportation example from earlier, we want to allow for the use of measurement outcomes to inform the choice of operations later in time. So that's where this word adaptive comes from. We want to be able to use the outcome and decide, based on that outcome, what to do later. So we developed three different approaches for using local adaptive circuits with measurements to prepare long-range entangled matter efficiently. And these are based on three very different physical insights: tensor networks, word normalization, and partons. And these three approaches have different advantages. So the tensor network approach is modular. It's a parallelizable approach that's very well suited for near-term experiments. On the other hand, the word normalization approach, as I'll show you, can be used to efficiently prepare quantum critical states, which are long-range entangled states at phase transitions between different quantum phases of matter. And finally, the parton approach allows us to prepare new classes of topological order, such as chiral topological order. These are basically analogs of things like the fractional quantum Hall effect. So due to the time constraint, I'll probably only be able to give you a flavor of probably the renormalization of the parton approaches, but I encourage you to check out our paper if you're interested in more details. Okay, so as I said, one of our approaches is based on this idea of renormalization, which is a very deep idea in theoretical physics. And the key idea of renormalization is basically just a reorganization of the degrees of freedom into those that matter most at different length scales. Right. So, for example, we can start out with the full many-body wave function, all the degrees of freedom at this lowest level, and then we might apply some local unitaries to disentangle some degrees of freedom. Those are these zeros popping out. And it's these degrees of freedom that will matter for short-distance physics, but matter less and less as you ask about longer-distance properties. So you can iterate this procedure of disentangling degrees of freedom until you're left with very few degrees of freedom at the top. And these are the most important degrees of freedom in asking about long distance properties. So this construction is known as the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MERA. It was developed by Guifer Vidal, who used to be here. And yeah, so it's a very powerful description of many-body wave functions. And due to its hierarchical nature, you can see that if you have a system size L, then due to this tree-like structure, its depth is only logarithmic in system size. So it turns out to be convenient to view this not just from the bottom up, but also from the top down. So if you view it from the top down, then you're basically starting out with a trivial product state, this all zero state, and then you're applying these unitaries in reverse to construct the original many-body wave function. So operated from top down, this gives you a unitary circuit for preparing the original many-body wave function at finer and finer length scales. However, an important catch is that such a unitary circuit has many non-local gates. As you can see, at very high levels in this MERA, these unitary gates couple degrees of freedom that are very far apart, right? And so this non-locality is often not very achievable in many of these Kahn-Harber approaches. So that's where measurements can help out a lot. So pretty much using this teleportation trick I presented at the very beginning, we can realize each non-local unitary gate using only a very short depth circuit involving local measurements and local unitaries. So basically each non-local unitary gate can be converted into a finite depth local adaptive circuit. And so the entire MERA just collapses into one local adaptive circuit that has pretty short logarithmic depth. So MERA is very powerful. It provides a good approximation for these quantum critical states. And it also exactly captures many topological orders of interest. So through this trick of using measurements, we can construct local adaptive circuits with only logarithmic depth for preparing all of the above. And again, this is in contrast with purely local unitary circuits, which would require depth of order system size to prepare all of these states. OK, the next approach I want to talk about is using this parton idea. So partons are a familiar concept from particle physics. As you all know, protons, neutrons, they're made out of quarks that are typically confined, but at very high temperature and high pressure, they might become deconfined. And remarkably, in topologically ordered matter, one can also find deconfined partons, which now emerge. They're not fundamental degrees of freedom. Rather, they emerge from the degrees of freedom the material were made of. So just to elaborate a little bit on that more, so even if we start out with a material made out of electrons or spins, in a topologically ordered phase, they may fractionalize into pieces that look nothing like the original degrees of freedom. And that's where the parton picture is quite valuable. It really captures this essence of fractionalization, which is at the heart of topological order. So let me just give you a very simple example of a Barton construction. Say we have a spin 1/2 degree of freedom. Well, we can imagine decomposing that spin 1/2 degree of freedom into four Majorana or Veal fermions. Okay. But we can't imagine too much. At the end of the day, we need to describe a spin 1/2 degree of freedom, which has two states, right, up and down. Whereas four real Majoranas constitutes a four-dimensional Hilbert space. So at the end of the day, we need to project back into our spin Hilbert space by imposing a constraint on the four Majoranas, namely that the product of the four is the identity. This will project us back into the proper two-dimensional spin Hilbert space. So how do we use this Parton building block to build different phases of matter? Well, there's this very trivial thing we can do, and that's just pair up the Majoranas within each spin cell, as shown here. And to be specific, by pairing the two Majoranas, I mean we put them in a state in which their product is one. We put them in a definite state where their product is one. And this type of phase of matter is manifestly trivial. Each spin is just decoupled from the other. And this is just a trivial product state. Okay. However, there's another way in which we can pair the Majoranas. We can pair the Majoranas between different spins. Okay. And now this is a deconfined model. And one way to see this is one can try moving a Majorana from here to here by applying a sequence of operators in this string-like fashion. Okay. And now, since these pairs of Majoranas were already in a definite state, the product of them was already one, and these were already one, then basically the string in the middle is invisible. It doesn't cost any energy. So basically the only energy cost is from the endpoints themselves. And this is the definition of deconfinement. So this is a picture of how these Majorana partons from this spin picture are deconfined and can move freely in this topologically ordered phase. Okay, and yeah, so this is a nice example of topological order. Okay, so where do measurements come into the picture? So we can turn this into a very nice adaptive circuit very simply. So first we can take the particle physics perspective and treat these partons actually as fundamental degrees of freedom that we have access to in the lab. Okay. So we can first prepare the simple parton state, this substrate. And this is simple because this is manifestly a product state of Majorana dimers. It can be prepared very easily in short depth. Okay. And then we use measurements. We measure these four Majorana operators for each cell. And then we get some outcome, plus or minus one. Okay. We want the outcome plus one. That's the constraint we want to impose. But due to the randomness of measurement, we can sometimes get minus one. But if we know the locations of these minus one defects, then it's simple to just apply some string of Majorana operators connecting the defects. And this will restore our state to the desired state, where they're uniformly plus one. Okay. So just to summarize, with three simple steps of preparing a simple parton state, doing these decoupled measurements, and then correcting for their outcome, we end up with a very short depth local adaptive circuit involving measurements for preparing this topologically ordered state. Okay, so there are many interesting parton constructions available in the literature, and they can all be built, they can all be used via measurements to create these local adaptive circuits. So, for example, there's a famous model in literature called the Kataev-Honeycomb model, in which he basically uses this same fractionalization of the spin into these four Majorana partons. And now, depending on which state you put these Majoranas in, you can have very interesting topological orders emerge. For example, if you put these, if you put one of the Majoranas into a chiral superconducting state, then you end up with chiral topological order after projecting back into the spin Hilbert space. So this is just an example in which with local adaptive circuits, you can prepare even chiral topological order in finite time. Okay, so yeah, I don't really have time to go into detail about the tensor network approach. Let me just briefly say that it involves splintering this many body wave function into a bunch of pieces, each of which can be prepared easily. They're just, in this case, 4-qubit states. This can be done in parallel. And then we can stitch them together with measurements to recover the target many-body state. That's pretty much all I wanted to say. So just to summarize, we have three different approaches of using measurements to facilitate the preparation of long-range entangled matter. These use tensor networks, normalization, partons, and they're very versatile and of different merits. So I think there are still many interesting questions left in this direction. One of the questions is, what exactly are the limitations of these adaptive circuits with measurements? Can they prepare any area loss state or no? And another interesting question is, basically, can we control the trajectories to prepare interesting mixed states? In the examples I gave you, we're targeting a single pure state. Basically, we're trying to engineer all the trajectories to converge into one, you know, interesting many-body wave function. But more generally, we might curate those trajectories in a more interesting way and get an ensemble of states that's also non-trivial. So measurement is a very powerful tool available in the lab, but it's also very hard to control. It has this intrinsic randomness associated with it. So I think there's a lot of room to explore in how exactly to control this randomness in a meaningful way to really use the power of measurement. So thanks a lot.
Tom. Questions?
I had a quick question. So this is a method for generating these very entangled states, right? Where there's lots of entanglement.
Yeah. But
I missed one basic point. Is there an Hamiltonian that?
Many of these states will have some parent Hamiltonian for which the state is a ground state. That's true, yeah.
But given the Hamiltonian, is this useful to find the ground state, or it's more I produce a funny ground state and then I have to find what Hamiltonian?
We're imagining a scenario where you have some controllable quantum system that's not necessarily engineering that Hamiltonian whose ground state is that state, right? So we're imagining like a programmable quantum simulator where you really need to build that ground state from scratch as opposed to relying on thermodynamics.
I see. Very good.
Am I correct that none of these protocols which you've described violate the standard non-signaling theorems?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're right. So you're worried that we seem to be getting something long-range very quickly, and we might worry about causality in the presence of these measurements, right? Yeah, so, So I kind of swept a couple things under the rug. So, So when I was talking about this local adaptive circuit, for the adaptive part, future operations can actually make use of all the classical information before it. Right, so in this sense, the classical information is non-local. It can be, we're assuming it can be distributed much faster than the quantum operations can be carried out. Right, so there, you can think of this as there's this fast classical information transfer that tells you what to do at the next step with local quantum operations, right? But let me also add that even if we did not have this feedback step, right, even if we didn't have this adaptive part, you could still have a measurement protocol with no feedback, which prepares a disordered topological order or long-range entangled state. It's just you would not be able to probe that in the lab, because to probe in the lab, you need to prepare that state over and over to you know, measure observables and, you know, use statistics. But you would not be able to guarantee that same trajectory over and over. Right? So it's really the adaptive part that's converging all these possible measurement trajectories toward a definite one, even though each trajectory is already topologically ordered. but it's not physical in the sense I just mentioned.
Thank you for the great talk. My question is, if we include the measurement during the evolution, how's the bound for the information propagation changes?
Well, it just fails to apply, right? So the bound, this light cone, really assumes local unitary gates, right? Yeah.
There is no causal structure.
Again, this ties into that question I put in the last slide about what are the limitations of this local adaptive circuit. There may be additional structures, just this is really a new thing that hasn't been studied, right? Yeah.
So this is not my field, and you'll have to explain this to me as though you're talking to a golden retriever or something, but I haven't seen any pictures of apparatus in your talk.
Okay, yes.
So I'm kind of an observer myself, so what does this look like? When you say long range, what does that mean? Is that a meter?
Yeah, so, you know, we're...
What kind of apparatus do you need to actually instantiate this?
Okay, but relative to black hole length scales, definitely not long range. but by long range, in condensed matter, quantum matter, we're always taking a thermodynamic limit, right? So we're considering a sequence of system sizes going to infinity, and we're asking about properties as we take that limit, right? So by long range entanglement, I mean that you can look at correlations between operators that you take farther and farther away in your system. And if they don't decay or they decay very slowly, it's like a power law, those are what we mean by long-range correlator, long-range entangled states. Okay, so, one maybe more simple example, just like a critical system, okay, like at a liquid gas transition, right? Sorry. Maybe gas-solid transition, yeah. But were you also asking about like the physical realization of this, maybe, or?
Yeah.
Okay,
I
probably shouldn't spend more time on that, so.
I'm just a curious cat, and not of the Schrodinger variety.
Right, so, okay.
I'm sorry, do you have a lab?
I don't have a lab.
Oh, you don't have a lab, okay.
No, I'm a theorist, so. I'm honored that wasn't clear.
Okay, well, that clears that up.
Yeah. Right, so I was alluding to these different quantum hardware platforms, right? So there are many different ways of engineering artificial two-level systems, or qubits, right? In this case, there are these Rydberg atom approaches. We encode, you know, the two levels of for different excited states of some atom or ion, right? In superconducting qubits, we also have these two-level systems. So there are all these, you know, artificial systems where we have really well-controlled two-level systems, these qubits, and then all these groups are trying to program these devices. They're trying to apply local unitary gates coupling these qubits. They're trying to measure them. This is all for the purpose of, much of it is motivated by quantum computing. Okay. And so these are the physical platforms that could be used to carry out the protocols I mentioned.
So these are in some sense simulations of experiments.
Yes. So for this, we're not thinking of like a solid state material, right? Like those, it would be too hard to coherently control the degrees of freedom. We really think of these artificial systems. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna throw this.
My leg is asleep. I have a very basic question. Is there any interesting difference between performing a measurement and then doing a conditional gate, or like performing an operation based on the outcome of the measurement, compared with doing a standard controlled gate?
Yes. So, you know, in the first case, after you made the measurement, that qubit is now in a definite state, right? Determined by the outcome, right? Whereas for the control gate, it's typically entangled with the thing you're controlling, right? So they are distinct operations.
Thank you. Yeah.